Okay, we have a little bit more time, so Barry thought maybe we could maybe have a little conversation. I don't know if people may have specific questions. I noticed a few things about the film as well. I mean, I love that film. I mean, I hope people enjoyed it. It's a really incredible movie. Just to start, is something I think we sort of implied it a little bit. At least I implied it a little bit in the introductory remarks. But and Kara talked about it, the whole L.A. rebellion thing. I mean, this film is definitely comes out of a very particular context, a very particular time, and a very particular set of preoccupations. I mean, as I understand it, like I said, Charles Haile Gerima and Larry Clark, I guess, would be the first of three black filmmakers who were at UCLA initially. I think Charles was there first. Larry Clark and Haile Gerima came in afterwards. And they, in a sense, they ended up creating a context for the people who followed, so that everybody who came behind them came into a context where the primary preoccupation was how real or possible is it to create a quote-unquote black cinema? And it's a sort of complicated question. I mean, because first of all, you know, we have to sort of have some framework on what black is, which is one of the ongoing preoccupations, minds, and I think many other people. And then also the question of what cinema is, and then so then what does black cinema become? So this is a film that in a lot of ways evolved out of those very, very particular set of preoccupations. You want to see, say, jump in.
Well, I think, I mean, one thing that I would say in addition to that is that it also addresses its context. So I mentioned that it was filmed in the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles, and one of the reasons that the LA Rebellion filmmakers are called the LA Rebellion filmmakers is because they were making films sort of in the wake of uprisings, or you probably heard of it as riots in Los Angeles in Watts. And so I think that that's part of the broader kind of context as well, that they're thinking about what film means and what it can do in a context in which, you know, a neighborhood has just been rebelling against the things that it was experiencing.
Yeah, I mean, the term I would say is oppositional. You know, it was a very oppositional stance. But you know, the thing about it is this whole notion of opposition is useful up to a point. But it's like when I was at Howard, say for example, and I talked to Haile. He would say, I would say, okay, we're here, we're trying to make films, and there's a question, okay, what are we trying to do? Okay, we're trying to make black cinema. So the first thing I would say, well, you know, obvious question, well, what is that? And the early answer was oftentimes something like it's not Hollywood, or it's against Hollywood. And so in a way, it created this kind of dichotomy that's useful, I guess, to a certain degree in the beginning, but it has very real limitations, you know. If you say it's not Hollywood, then if you follow that line of thinking, it would be like, okay, so if Hollywood is color, so are our films supposed to be in black and white? Now, that might sound like silly or ridiculous, but these were the kinds of things that people were asking themselves. So I would say, like, okay, if Hollywood has narrative, does that mean that black film doesn't have narrative? You know, these kinds of things. But people were really struggling with what it would mean to sort of arrive at a cinema, and the way I pose it myself in the past, because I like to use a musical analogy, because I think black music is this space where black Americans in particular feel like we've been able to create a complex actualization of who we are culturally, existentially, all these kinds of things. So the question would be, like, is it possible to create a cinema that has the breadth, the beauty, the complexity, the alienation of black music, you know? So that to me was the kind of frame, and it's a very convenient frame way to try to look at something like this, which is clearly very preoccupied with notions like the blues and what a blues aesthetic, what a blues ethos, a blues philosophy, a blues worldview, what would that be and what would that look like in filmic terms? I don't know if that makes sense. And one more thing, I noticed, it's so funny. One of the things about this film, about why it really wasn't available for a long time, and I think it's part of the context and process in which it was made, as she said, Kara said, it was a thesis film. But, you know, the film, people saw the film and said, this is a masterwork, this is incredible. But basically, Charles, he has all that music in it, like Earth, Wind, and Fire, and stuff like that. They couldn't get the rights to any of that music. I mean, basically, part of the process of what they call the restoration of the film was them basically raising money to get the rights to things like This Bitter Earth, Reasons, Earth, Wind, and Fire. That's expensive music to get, right? Like I noticed, if you look in the credits, at the end it says Dinah Washington, it says This Bitter Earth, and then it says Unforgettable. Because the first life of this film, he had two Dinah Washington songs. It was in that scene where they're dancing, which I think is the greatest scene in the history of, I mean, it's one of the greatest films in the history of American cinema, certainly. I would say it's the single greatest scene in the history of Black American cinema, right? He uses that song, This Bitter Earth. But in the end of the film, it wasn't that same song. It was Dinah Washington singing Unforgettable, Unforgettable, which works, you know, it's great. But he used it because it was a money thing, basically. They couldn't afford to get two Dinah Washington songs, so they just repeated that song. But what it does to the film is kind of interesting because it ties, it functions structurally. It ties the film together in the kind of way that it didn't happen initially. I mean, it was sort of implied because you heard Dinah Washington's voice twice. But now to repeat that song, it makes the end of the film loop back to that particular moment, which I thought was interesting. I don't know. I was thinking about it a little bit. So,
I think, I mean, if people have thoughts, I'd be interested to know, you know, sort of from a few of you, if you have questions or thoughts about it that you want to raise.
Also, I take responsibility for running out of microphones, so you might have to speak up.
Don't get me started on that one.
So the question was, what happened to Black cinema? Because I see so much hope in this film. So what's happened to Black cinema since then, right? So he said he said this film was properly sick, right? So if that makes sense to everyone, then I think that's a good shorthand, right?
Yeah, I mean, hey, don't get me started on this one. I feel like I was just saying to Barry, you know, one of the ongoing preoccupations is, you know, this idea of Blackness, Black aesthetics. But I think an important question that kind of comes up a lot is like, well, why would this matter to anybody besides Black folks? You know? Why would the preoccupation with Black aesthetics, Black circumstances, these kinds of things matter to anybody else? And one short answer I've heard is that, well, because given the nature of how Black people have been situated in various social contexts, we are like on the front lines. It was like somebody described as being like a canary in a mine shaft. A lot of the things that the Black community has experienced are things that larger groups are going to experience as we move, you know, globalization, these kinds of things, displacement, all these kinds of things. You get to see in the Black community a community that has been subject to some of the most problematic forces, you know, social forces and stuff. And one of the things I think that's interesting to think about, just to make a kind of leap back to the music thing and why I think the music thing is important in terms of thinking through or thinking about what's possible in cinema, is like, what is the basis of the power of Black music in the world? Like, I was really struck, you know, when we were downstairs, there was music was playing, it was rave or something. But to me, that's just another variation of Black music, Black American music. So it's really interesting to think, well, why is it? why might one think Black American music has the kind of power that it has? And we're not, I'm not, now here I'm not talking about African music, I'm talking about music of the diaspora. Why does it have a certain kind of power? Well, one explanation is this, is on one hand, if you take the notion that in the natal or original context in which Black music's evolved or developed, like say Africa, there's a lot of different musics in Africa. You're talking about a 1,000-year-old tradition of making music, and then you take people and you forcibly take them to a new context, right? Where, in a sense, something almost paradoxical happens in that, on one hand, people of African descent are forcibly brought to the Americas, and their movement is circumscribed radically. They can't go where they want to go. They can't be with who they want to be with, all these kinds of things. But one of the paradoxical things that kind of happened was this, was that the music in its natal context is like a lot of musics. It's music that was subsidized by the ruling class. You could almost say the music had a kind of equivalent relationship to the ruling class of like Western painting. Like if you look at the history of Western painting, the subject matter of most Western painting at a certain point is religious subject matter because that's who was subsidizing the painters. At a certain point, it's the middle class because that's who's subsidizing the painters and stuff. So the music, in a sense, in its traditional context, is a music that more or less is music that sings the stories, the narratives of the ruling class. Now, one of the things that kind of happens, like I said, paradoxically, is when Black people are enslaved, they end up in Americas. What you end up with is this rich, incredible musical tradition which had been yoked to the narratives of the ruling class in a natal context now being unleashed. In other words, you got this, it's like if you could take all the resources of NASA and apply them to the concerns of, like, say, Chicano gangbangers or something, you know? I mean, that's a crazy notion. But you know what I'm trying to say? It's like you got this incredible form, rich form, that's used for one thing, but now all of a sudden, not only is that form being used to tell these other stories, but it's being used to tell the stories of peasant class, working class people, but not just peasant and working class people, but peasant and working class people who find themselves in one of the most dramatic circumstances in the history of mankind, meaning enslavement and all this kinds of stuff. So I think the combination of those forces align themselves to create what we call Black music. I think that's why Black music speaks to people all over the world, not just Black people. So the question for me, and I think it's a question that certainly has evolved from me being a student, because Haile certainly is my mentor, Charles is a person I know really well, is the question of, like, how do you take those same set of circumstances? Is it possible to apply these things to another medium? Cinema in this instance, but it don't have to be cinema. It could be any medium in which Black people, women, say for example, like women in architecture, where we haven't been able to see what another group of people with a different set of circumstances and preoccupations, what those things might manifest themselves. So to me, that's one of the things that's interesting about this question of Black cinema. It goes back to you saying why this film is so sick. I think this film is crazy sick because Charles is a product of a certain community. He's a Southerner who grew up like many people in South Central LA. And he, for a series of kind of almost unquantifiable circumstances, found himself in a situation where he attempted and had a certain kind of support to apply these things to this particular medium. I mean, did you notice how, like, it'll say actor, Charles Bracy, starring as Bracy, and then it comes up sound recorder, Bracy. You know what I mean? Or Angela Burnett, like the little girl, that's his niece. You know what I mean? You see her grow up in the movie. It's like no continuity. She's a baby in the beginning. She's like about 5 or 6 in the end, you know? So, but those, you know, I don't think that stuff kind of doesn't matter because what you're left with is the force of Charles's vision, I think. And the question is, how do we build on it? That's the question we, Black filmmakers, I mean, asking themselves a lot. How come Charles can make this film with $10,000 grant or something like that, and then you end up with millions of dollars to make films and you can't even get close to making something as powerful as this. So it forces us to even think about what are resources? You know, what does it mean to have resources? You know, typically in a film, if you want to shoot it from beginning to end, you start and you want to finish as quickly as possible. But he shot this film over 2, almost 3 years on the weekends. So that's something that typically would be considered a deficit that then maybe becomes an asset, you know? So it's like, how do we reimagine how we approach what we do out of the context of market forces and capital forces and all these kinds of things?
I think there's someone.
Yeah, I lost my.
So the Watts Rebellion was in 1965 and was in response to this protest in 1990 was shot by the police. And there was one thing you guys could comment on the fact that there is no police in the film, no reference to police in the film.
Well, I mean, there's a sonic reference, like you hear police, you know, sirens. The question was why, because the Watts Rebellion happened in 1965 and was in response to someone being shot by a police officer, and the question was why were there no references to police in this film? Right, and so I was beginning to respond by saying that there actually are references and there's sonic references, so you can hear police sirens, you know, at different moments in the film. So the and then the continuation of the question was, well, but it seemed like the sirens were far away, and so there's no direct way that there is a confrontation with the police in that's being staged in the film.
Right.
Okay, and so was there something about the LA Rebellion where they were sort of interested in not having that presence, or was that part of the way that they wanted to work? So start, right? One of the things I would say is that the one of the reasons I wanted to show you Bush Mama at the beginning was to say that there's a very different, the aesthetic of the LA Rebellion is not one that we would just identify aesthetically, we would identify it more ideologically. So we wouldn't say everyone's doing a similar kind of thing aesthetically. But I think that the larger question around sort of the political impetus of the LA Rebellion, part of it was to challenge Hollywood images. But another part of it, I think, was also to do that in a way that actually brings to the fore some of the most pressing forces, right, on Black life, but also then what it might mean to try to put in place a different system for valuing Black life than the dominant narrative or the dominant Hollywood narrative film's system of valuing things, right? So part of the challenge, I think, was aesthetically to come up with a way of, you know, I mean, in some ways sort of entirely rethinking what it might mean to create an aesthetics that people can connect to and understand and feel with, right? Like have a certain kind of empathy for people who had been so sort of unvalued or devalued. And so part of it is not just to value according to the same structures, the same aesthetic structures, but to say, is there a different way for that to happen? So I think for me, anyway, the references, the sonic references, even though they're far away, are part of the milieu in which that has to happen, right? So it's part of the entire sort of system of forces that has to be this present, that's exerting an influence, but it's not the sort of, I don't know how to put it, maybe defining factor or something like that in terms of like what the texture of this life is, right?
I mean, it's hard, you know, Denise, it's hard to me, like, to say exactly what Charles was thinking, like, I don't know what maybe, whether he, that was intentional on this part, but one thing I might suggest is that, you know, a lot of times, like, resistance, per se, is not so linear, I think. A lot of times, like, resistance might have more to do with the fact that, you know, that's a very familiar representation of Black people being in a certain sort of direct confrontation with police forces and stuff. And I would probably suggest that Charles was much more interested in creating a rendering of Black life in which white society, white police forces and stuff like that just weren't central to Black people's lives, daily lives and preoccupations. It's not to say that it's not there. It's always there, but just the idea that, like, you know, we don't sit up, all our time is not sit up thinking about what white folks are doing, like in the context of America, you know what I mean? That's not real, because there's a certain kind of negative fantasy, I think, that says we're always being thought about, people who are in power are always being thought about, you know what I mean? And that there isn't a whole bigger life, you know, beyond like the actual material dimensions of oppression and stuff like that, that people find. You know, even because, like, to me, this film is definitely a film that's got a lot of tragedy, obviously, running through it. It's like coursing through the film. But what you see is, like, people getting on with their lives. And I think it's something to be said about those particular types of renderings. Because I think if you have a police run through there, in a sense, it's like, in a sense, that's dramatic. It's dramatic, you know. And this film, I think, is kind of, in a way, trying to get at, like, something like more philosophical and deeper about just the nature of life. And also it becomes a point of universalism too, I think, to just show a life. I mean, I think, you know, if you say you compare this to something like, you know, neorealism, like I know like one filmmaker that Charles was obsessed with, I know he was obsessed with him because he used to talk about him all the time, is this Italian filmmaker Ermanno Olmi. I don't know if people know Ermanno Olmi. His most famous film is this film called The Tree of Wooden Clogs, which is a very, almost, it seems like a real-time treatment of the life of a peasant family in Italy, like I think in the early part of the century. And Charles really, really liked that film. He liked that filmmaker, like down to the fact that Ermanno Olmi was a car-carrying Marxist, right, unrepentant, who was a director and a cinematographer, which is not that typical for a person to direct and shoot films themselves. He also was very invested in the idea of going to communities and working with people. These are all things that I know, you know, meant a lot to Charles at this point in his filmmaking career. So I think those kinds of connections may have something to do with the particular type of rendering that Kill a Sheep is, which really doesn't look like any other film that Charles made, frankly, too. It's a very specific film in his total output, so.
I see. Yeah, I want to see if there's anyone over here, because I feel like I have it seen over there, but I do see a question here. So, anyone? No. Okay.
Left bias.
Then we don't have to say it twice.
Mine wasn't a question, it was really a response to what you said, Denise, and clearly I couldn't tell you why, but I could tell you, as a Black man, what it did for me sitting here. And so part of sort of the sonic references reminds me of, and saw so many Black male bodies, so having to live in states of hypervigilance all the time. And so the sonic reference is the replaying in your consciousness all the time. And so it's visceral for me. And that in many ways, the confrontation with police is not always visual, but it's the visceral response. I mean, it's the sonic response that creates the fear. And so that's what it is.
Yeah, because that kind of violence that we didn't see here but was very prevalent, it kind of infiltrates everything, I suppose, in everyday life. So it was very present, this kind of invisible violence. And I really enjoyed the fact that it gave it a different taste, that whole history and that whole experience, that thing of shifting the image and just giving a new taste of that. I think it was very poignant.
I like your reference to taste, too, because for me it is a very, you're saying visceral, like, you know, but also, I mean, the fact that you could bring taste in when talking about a film, like, and you're not just talking about, you know, like, somebody's taste, whether it's like middle brow taste or something, but like a real taste, I think is really remarkable, and I think a testament to what Burnett did achieve with this film.
I felt like also they sort of dealt with the police really early with the two lads with the TV, wherein the older chap was like, oh, maybe going to phone the police. And they sort of self-policed themselves, but they also dealt with that early on and then were like, that's not what the film's about, though. And it's not necessarily about that relationship, but much more about the sort of interpersonal relationships. So I kind of saw that as like sort of kind of, brushing that to the side in a good way. Like, you know, that's what could happen, but also it doesn't need to in this context.
I mean, there's a film that I like a lot. This film made by this filmmaker's the Hughes Brothers called Menace to Society. I don't know, maybe anybody's seen. Like, Menace to Society is interesting to me because it's a film pretty much in the same community made in the 80s. I mean, it's set in the 80s, I guess. And it's kind of like Killer Sheep, but with all this stuff folded back into it, like police, hyper-vigilant state and all this kind of stuff. And it's also got the same kind of melancholy strand in it, in a sense. But I do think, you know, just to reiterate, I think one of the things that's particularly oppositional and radical about this film is the way it refuses to bring figures of consideration into the frame that aren't really kind of central to people's lives. You know, the whole idea that, like, no, it's kind of like, you know, like, there's a film, strange for me to say it like this, but like this film, Daughters of the Dust, which I worked on or whatever. But the thing about it that I remember people saying was like, one, it's a film that's got all these black women in it, right, at the turn of the century. That one of the most radical things about it was like, if you went to see it and you weren't a black woman, that it forced you to extend yourself beyond the normal parameters of your identification. In other words, it's a film, Daughters of the Dust.
And I would say, just because AJ probably won't say this, but Daughters of the Dust was part of L.A. Rebellion, exactly. And like later sort of second wave of L.A. Rebellion, mm-hmm. So it came out in 89?
Daughters? Daughters is 91, 92.
90, okay, so Daughters came out, but she was filming it for... Or you all were filming it for a while.
No, she was thinking about
right,
it.
Right,
actually raises the interesting thing I would just say real quick, too, that I think actually speaks to Denise's question. Because filmmaking is a capital, less so now with digital technology and stuff, but for so long, filmmaking was a capital-intensive medium. So unlike music, where if something is going down, the music will reflect it fairly quickly, you know what I mean? Film, not so much, because it's a lag time between when something actually is happening psychically, like 65, when you might see it manifested in a film. I mean, because people didn't even have access to the tools, the means of production. I mean, one of the things that's central to understanding why we had this eruption of talent, like in a way, was because at UCLA, what they found was an institutional framework where they actually had access to the means of production and a cadre of people who were working together around similar ideological premises and stuff, you know? And it's also interesting that as soon as everybody graduated, almost everybody's production fell off precipitously, you know?
Yeah,
so it was
that
a
would
serious
be
concern.
One of the answers to your question as well about what happened. But we, I mean, I know we need to wrap up, so I would just say that Daughters of the Dust, in my opinion, you know, is one of the films that you could put in this line that still, I think, would be compelling to look at for people who are interested in this type of filmmaking that's trying to do something different, you know. So thanks so much for being here.
Is it still on?
Still on?
Do you want to make an announcement?
Oh, just that the club's starting. Hello. Also, just to say that the club is starting in 45 minutes at Stereo, so I hope to see a lot of you there. That's it. Or tomorrow. We start at 2 o'clock tomorrow with Fred and Sadia, and then opening that up to a discussion with all of us. So if you can't make it to the club, I hope to see you tomorrow. All right, thank you.